Hello, everybody, and welcome to yet another episode of the Next Best Picture podcast. I have with me today the likely soon-to-be Oscar-nominated set decorator of Blade Runner 29, Alessandra Carzuela. Alessandra, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm great. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on with us today. Now, before we get into your incredible work on Blade Runner, I would like to ask you just a couple questions about your wonderful career as a whole. So could you tell us a little bit about what it is you do, and more specifically, how it is you became a set decorator?
Well, I started working pretty early when I was 18 in Venice during my Accademia of Belle Arti courses. And I've been, you know, taken into the movie, the industry business from there, and kind of starting from the very bottom up. I've been doing a lot of theater at the very beginning, and then slowly I got into the international pond, and I've been so lucky to be working in many big projects from the beginning, which gave me the right scale of a kind of project, you know. So, yes, I've been very lucky.
Well, you've certainly come to a wonderful project to start with, and we're very glad you made your way there. So I guess one of the big stories in this film is that you and production designer Dennis Gassner worked with cinematographer Roger Deakins on this previous film. I know Deakins largely avoided looking at the previous Blade Runner film for inspiration. Did you and Gassner do that as well? Did you kind of try to strike out in your own direction? Or did you allow the previous film to influence you, the original Blade Runner?
Oh, well, no. We didn't try to avoid the original Blade Runner. It simply wasn't that necessary. You know, it was a reference that wasn't with us every day. When I came on board, Dennis and Roger and Denis, they had already, you know, several meetings about creating the new world. And yes, I started a little bit later, but in the meantime, I was following from the distance all this how, you know, ideas were developed. And I did the job on my side. I started looking at all the possible design, all the possible moods that could fit into this world, which was just nearly, you know, at the first stage of creation. And simply all this pond of references came very useful by the time that we all grouped in Budapest and we got it done. I have to say that the brutalist word was a must from the very beginning. And respectful, you know, the first Blade Runner, we were not going into any baroque vision, and we were trying to build our own world in consequence of what happened with the first Blade Runner.
So I guess when you say there was a lot of brutalist influence there, was that largely brought about by the fact that you shot in Hungary? Was this something where I know Los Angeles's own environment, like the Bradbury Building, provided a lot of ready-made environments for the first Blade Runner? Were there places in Hungary where basically you didn't have to do much work because this setup was already pretty much there?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, we built largely, you know, kind of all the sets. And we shot outside on location a couple of times. But the advantage to be in Budapest was that there was a vibe going around when you were going home from the studio, when you were going to the studio every morning. And we were fully immersed, you know, in this environment. It was brutal and was kind of not graceful. There are many, many locations in Budapest that were really inspiring. But pure Budapest, I know that Roger and Denis, they were looking at the brutalism in London because they wanted to shoot there. And that kind of very good point of start inspiration for all of us. Also because we had to try to keep minimal.
No, I would say, right, yes. Yeah, so you want it to be a minimalist look, I guess, kind of this dark, bleak future.
Yes, exactly. But we had to ground it all. We had to create, you know, good roots. That's why I keep saying they're looking at the design from the 30s on has been of great help. In reality, if you look at the movie, there are several unique, historical design pieces, but you don't quite notice them because they are very well hidden in the sets. So to me, this was the key, using a sign, an object, a chair, a table, without showing off, you know, the source, the design, or, you know, the impact that could disturb our minimalist story.
Now, could you tell me where some of those moments are, those things we didn't notice?
Yes, I was quite pleased, in the very beginning, in the first part. Kay goes to visit in a retired home. And that was one of the rare moments where we've been shooting on location and in a very nice and sweet historical building. And I was really, really, you know, looking for something really good to dress the set. That was, you know, a kind of retired home, but still, you know, you couldn't go for normal furniture. And so all of the sudden with Dennis, we've been looking at the Bauhaus furniture, which actually we bought for nuts in Slovakia. And that was the key for the look of the place, because the little tubular chromium frame of the armchairs, they were just enough bleaking and cold in that very historical place. And I did see this on the big screen, and I was very pleased. You know, to me, it was kind of the key that I've been pursuing the all, you know, 8 months, along with a lot of building, a lot of designing, a lot of making up furniture, which we had.
We're talking about little details. Tell me about some of the other spaces. You know, the retirement home sounds like something you put a lot of thought into, but obviously Kay's home is a place that there's a lot of details in. So tell me some of the things you hid there that audiences might not have noticed.
Well, funny enough, Kay's apartment is the only specific place where there is a homage to the first Blade Runner. If you look in the kitchen, it's all there. We made the kitchen very small. We've been working a lot in general in that place. But the thing that we wanted to show was that the kitchen was kind of a sailing boat kitchen, was a spare ship kitchen, and it's really lovely. We manufactured all, we made it in real stainless steel, and we mounted all the pieces totally functionally. And Roger did his best work with lighting, and so that to me was the best part of the apartment.
Now, Deakin, you mentioned Roger Deakins. His work in here is obviously stunning. I know a lot of people want to see him win an Oscar for this. Can you tell me a little bit more about working with Roger, you know, with his very distinct colors and some of the very complex lighting rigs he set up in general?
Oh, yes, we've been working very close. I mean, I met Roger already in the past because I was part of the team of the Skyfall and Quantum of Solace. But in this case, we had to work so close basically we projected and made all the, half of the lighting, which you see on screen. And it's been a long journey because everything has to combine together, like the style of the light, the type of lighting, and the result of it, using special fluorescence LEDs tubes. There was a drama to providing time and all of that. but it's been really, really a terrible achievement for all of us. And you can see on the screen all this.
Oh, his work in there. It's incredible.
It was kind of a second job on top of the set decoration.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but no, but in a very good way, you know, in a very, very good way, because that's the reason why everything is evident that has come together on the screen. Because all the department, we've been working together, confrontation, we have discussions, there is no one drawing which hasn't been submitted and discussed by, you know, by Roger, by the visual effects team. It was hard work from this point of view, but the result is amazing. And I really, really, I'm so impressed about the producers. They allowed us to do all of that. Because, of course, this costs money.
Oh, yeah.
Time and, you know, all everything costs money. And I've been really impressed that they've been supporting us until the last day. Yeah.
So, not related to Blade Runner, but because you mentioned working with Roger on Skyfall, I have wondered for 5 years, how on earth did you guys set up that scene in the Shanghai neon sign fight? Do you know what I'm talking about, back in Skyfall?
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Well, that's a strange story, because we were supposed to... Well, you know, we Dennis Gassner and Anna Pinnock, I've been kind of... I was the outpost person. So for Skyfall, we were supposed to shoot in Shanghai in the real casino, which collapsed couple of months before shooting. So they totally changed idea, and we built everything in London, and I've been just simply sending containers and containers of materials to get the build done correctly. And but then I was sent to Turkey, and I wasn't part of that shooting.
Oh, okay.
But that was really fun in Turkey, even more fun, I think. You know, all the train sequence.
Oh, yeah.
How complicated it was to secure the train track for kilometers by kids running around and going and during all the rehearsal. It's been really, really an enormous work, an enormous effort.
Yeah. Oh, it must have been so stressful. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
So, speaking of places you have to secure, I guess big crowded spaces. Tell me a little bit about the Vegas Hotel and what you put into, because that's a very striking set in Blade Runner.
It was a huge space. We shot in the MTV building, who was totally empty, three stores.
It was the MTV building, you said?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Vision, the old Magyar television building.
Oh, that's so cool.
It was totally abandoned. And that location leads us then to the set built on the stage that was the penthouse, which I had a lot of fun in doing it. You know, really, really a lot of fun. It was 200 square meters, and I remember making some decision, like having, you know, original American furniture flew over. Because it wouldn't been impossible to get the same scale of sofas in Europe in any way. And we really wanted to make it kind of American look. And I think that we did.
I mean, honestly, I didn't know until after I was looking at credits on the film that you guys had shot this so much in Europe. So you guys masked very well the fact that this was... I mean, obviously, Vegas is not a nuclear wasteland, so it couldn't have been Vegas, but it certainly looked like it. What about those statues outside? The, you know, the kissing female statues.
Oh, well, that's our magic supervising art director, Rod. That has been following, and the making of them, it's all real. You know, we built enormous gigantic statues, and we've been shooting in an enormous stage, like it was a real desert, with really, really, again, minimum CGI effects needed. And so that was a really, really challenging set, and again, a gigantic set. that, you know, allow us to not to use so much green screen and the normal tricks.
Well, I was going to ask. So I know they were very adamant about the fact that there were essentially no green screens used in making this film. So how did you guys pull off some of those massive spaces in cityscapes?
Well, I mean, yes, we built very large sets, but also, and this was such a fun thing because it's a technique that, you know, is from the past, that we did miniatures. Like in front of Kay's apartment windows, we built a facade with one third of little apartment Hong Kong style, and we dressed it with one third furniture, and you know, and everything was miniaturized. But this thing made the whole environment so real, and we did the same in the rooftops, which is actually my favorite set. And we built miniature as a background, and the whole thing worked so well, and because it was real.
So it's very Star Wars, I guess. All those overheads, you know, of the cities and stuff, all miniatures. That's so neat. Okay, so another thing I'm curious about is how you guys wove in product placement. Because obviously, you know, every time you go outside, you mention the rooftops, we see flashing Sony logos and, you know, so tell me a little bit in Coke, tell me a little bit about how product placement impacts this world and how you incorporated it.
Well, I mean, it wasn't, I think it was more like the other way around. I know that Denny wanted to keep some of the big advertise billboards and signs from the previous Blade Runner. And that simply happened. But we had no pressure whatsoever from product placement or, you know, we wanted those advertised to be on set because they were a kind of a link with the previous Blade Runner.
Right.
So they were simply a piece of furniture, not an intrusive moment in your dressing, you know?
So you mentioned that the rooftop was your favorite, though. The rooftop's very striking, but what made the rooftop your favorite to decorate?
First of all, it was the kind of brutal look at the maximum stage kind of thing, you know, mm-hmm. much more than the Wallace. Wallace was brutal, but kind of ornate in colors and settings and lighting. The rooftops, it was just fantastic for the lighting. We choose with Roger, which is enormous industrial fluorescence that we put vertical all along the building. And that was really, really cool. Plus the colors, you know, blue, red, green, and all this, setting of advertising, the little miniature. And it was raining on set. It was fog on set on the stage. So it was really magic, you know. We were really on top of the world.
Those are such haunting shots, too. That's such a beautiful scene where he has his digital girlfriend up there and then he freezes her, or she freezes in the rain. So you did an absolutely marvelous job setting those up and making that environment haunting. I guess the next big space, since you kind of mentioned it, is Wallace's. I mean, you said it's brutalist, but also ornate. Tell me a little bit about the inspirations for Wallace's headquarters.
Well, for Wallace, we had a strange process. Well, not strange, a different process. We kind of took away suggestions and furniture because it was at the beginning, the idea was to have a much more elaborate space, more armchairs, more sculptures, more side tables, different things. And then through the days, working all together with Roger that wanted a special atmosphere there, with Denis that wasn't sure what more organized space would have looked. And me, that I wasn't really keen on making a meeting room out of the set. So day by day, we kind of loose elements, and that was their right key to give Wallace a word. I think that only two little statues of samurai.
Yeah.
Yes, which belong from a local artist, which we've been looking a lot of local artists to. Were kept on the set, and a wonderful low table by Willy Rizzo stayed. But it was just the right move, because those were kind of difficult sets. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to dress with nothing, you know. It's easier to dress with a bulk of stuff. Anyway.
Well, the emptiness was palpable there. I mean, it did make me feel lonely just to be there. Okay, so another one I'm curious about is, I noticed that a lot of the computers and computer monitors were very big, blocky. They felt like something you would have had in the early 2000s or the late 1990s, instead of what you usually see in sci-fi, which is very tiny, sleek monitors. How did y'all choose to go for kind of the vintage computer look?
Well, it was necessary to have, you know, to mark a contrast with rich and poor. Of course, Love Office, she has a very sleek and modern small screen, which was integrated in the very long table, which we don't see that much. And comparing with the Dr. Budge, office with all the little monitors and, you know, 70s little TVs were light up. Because, you know, the poor had no possibility to have more expensive and elaborate technology after the big blow in 2022.
Right.
Yes. So that was a kind of sign of kind of social diversity, you know, different.
I guess I didn't originally plan to ask about this, but we're talking about social diversity. One of the most striking sets in the film is the orphanage in San Diego. Tell me a little bit about designing that.
Oh, well, as soon as my team started in Budapest, the next day we started to build those tables. And because we made them, and they were 240.
Oh, my God.
Yes, 240. We bought, tons and tons and tons and tons of metal bits. And we've been sizing all that. We gave them a regular size just to avoid the Dickens kind of atmosphere. We made them very regular in line. And we give them all those electronics material to work with. So it's been one of those, you know, gigantic sets that I couldn't have done without my team, like Trash Mesa. You know, Trash Mesa, I don't know if it's clear when you look at the screen, mm-hmm. but it's a kind of three football pitch crater, empty, and we simply dressed with metal and with fake metal. We have, two gigantic Arctic from Italy with the special materials cut. Mm. So that all the stunt action could happen without harm anyone. But that was an enormous job. Enormous, enormous job. And no green screen.
There was no... Oh, my God. That's so insane. Those sets were so cavernous.
Yeah. And when they scrambled down from that part of the hill... Mm-hmm. That's all polystrain materials that we bought. They were all blue because they only come in blue. And we've been painting them for 2 weeks in the open air because we had so much material that we couldn't even find a stage to paint them.
Oh my God.
Of course, the weather was already October, so you know everything was wet and nothing was drying up. So it was a bit of a challenge, but it really looked great. It really looked great, you know.
Oh, it looked incredible.
My team did an incredible job, and I would have not done it without them anyway.
So, you know, that's something where you put a lot of effort into building massive scales of something that at least on a single viewing, you know, might at first go unnoticed. What are some other areas, details that you put a lot of effort into that didn't make it onto screen or that are not immediately obvious, No, just little Easter eggs, anything in there.
Oh, well, I mean, I have no idea how much it can be revealed in the making of, of the movie. But, for instance, Kay's environment, all his big building, it was a 6 stories staircase, totally dressed, which, of course, got lost during the, I mean, it's not, hasn't come up.
Yeah.
But that was a really, really big set too. And I think that we do get a bit of the hallway with the cages, with men living in cages.
Yes, right before he goes into his room, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And that was really fun in doing it because we've been looking into the Hong Kong cage houses, and we kind of revisited that concept. It was really good. But another gigantic set, which is not coming up, but it will probably in the videos, in the DVDs and all that, I think.
That's so cool. I'm sorry we didn't get to see that, although if the previous Blade Runner is any indication, we'll see 3 or 4 more versions of this one. So a question just about you and your history with films. I noticed that you, is it a coincidence that you have a number of faith-based films you worked on? Ben-Hur, Risen, The Nativity Story?
Oh, yes. I think so.
Oh, okay. Well, so what yeah.
Because those three movies are quite different stories altogether, you know? Like Ben-Hur was a story. Risen, which I really loved a lot working with Kevin Reynolds, was a different story again. And the Nativity Story was a kind of Christmas tale thing. So, no, I think it's just a coincidence.
Would you say that Blade Runner is in any way a faith-based film?
It's a very romantic film to me.
Yeah.
I always felt that Case, he's a really romantic hero. More than faithful, he's romantic, yes.
He's Ryan Gosling, so by the nature of being Ryan Gosling alone, I guess he's very romantic. What about your interaction with Renee April, or April, I'm hopefully not butchering her name too much, the costume designer on the film? How did you collaborate with her?
Oh, like we did with all the other departments, plus keep on warning each other about colors. About, for instance, for the BB's bar, our interaction was very important because, the sets was designed in a kind of way that had to give the right place to their characters. And the colors were important there. And the kind of, I've lost it.
No worries. No, I mean, the colors being important is, I'm sure that was something both with Deakins' heavy blues and oranges, and also with the, the many colorful jackets with the prostitutes and stuff. There was quite a bit of collaboration that had to go on there.
But also, for instance, in Love's Office, it was fundamental that because I wanted to go with white and she wanted to go with white, and normally you don't do the you don't match the armchairs with the with the outfit,
right?
But in that we decided that was the only way to do it, like everything white. And in fact, there is that shot that she's having her nail done, which is simply spectacular, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's a case where a design icons get, kind of hidden and not too exposed, because that was original Paul Polin armchairs and all that. But you hardly notice that, and I'm so pleased about it,
In that scene, it's so wonderful. It tells so much about her character, too. It's a perfect way to get to know her. Before I ask you a few specific Oscar questions, is there anything else you would like people to know about your work in Blade Runner? Because obviously you were integral in making this vibrant world come to life, things you're particularly proud of or things you think people find particularly fascinating.
Well, I'm very proud of our making of things. I'm very proud of how we all together worked at the technology, because that was a very difficult task involving many departments. We've been working with the local team of prop maker, and it took a while for us to get in sync with the requirements, but at the end I think that the job is just fantastic. Like the bone scanner at the very beginning, I think it's a wonderful piece of prop that we made, and
the ships as well. I thought the ships were fascinating.
Yes, they are.
And then also that the one kind of traditional house, the very beginning where Dave Bautista lives. I thought that was wonderful. Both that, and I know this was more April's work, but his bio suit he wore, I thought were too fascinating.
It was great. And, well, but, you know, even the nursery tent was incredible. We've been using those sacks, which are coming from an Italian producer and who made algae, spirulina algae for real. And they use more or less the same system, like filtering water in growing up algae. It's kind of the same thing that Dave Bautista was doing, like he was growing worms. And I found it really great because we used their sacks, their system, and that was really fun. Yes, it was.
Were there any ideas you had for the set that made their way into the film and directly impacted the plot? Was there anything that wasn't in the script that just a prop or an object you guys put on screen that Denis was like, ooh, we need to find a way to incorporate this?
Well, I remember that one day Dennis came to my office saying, oh, we have few days, but we need to work on media station. So it was a Thursday, I think. So we went down to our warehouse, and because we have a lot of electronic and computer parts and everything still left behind from the dish, we've been assembling a couple of media stations in a couple of days, with everybody contributing and all that. And then, of course, you can see this media station in every single set. They were not planned, they were not even designed, but made on the spot, on the hot spot, with Dennis supervising, my boys building it. And you can see this media station everywhere, and that's really a pleasure. And it doesn't change the plot, but we get a nice, great connection with the first Blade Runner.
The fact that it's present everywhere is so cool as well. Now, the last question I wanted to ask you, since this is an awards podcast and an awards website, among films you've seen this year, and I know you're very, very busy, are there any that, aside from Blade Runner, which I hope and think will get nominated for Best Production Design, are there any other films that particularly stood out for you for their set decoration and production design?
Well, I had the chance to see The Darkest Water.
Oh, The Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's fantastic. I think it's really, it would be my favorite.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Yeah.
Other than Blade Runner, I assume.
Well, I don't know. I'm not American, and it's difficult for me to read things in that perspective. If we get nominating, okay, it's good fun. But I'm kind of, suspicious about all that.
Oh, okay.
Too much drums.
Mm.
So let's see. It's been a great journey for me. It's been wonderful working with Dennis. has been, you know, one of the rare cases where you do all the creative process correctly, and it did work. So that's what counts in this moment.
Well, it came, the final product was just visually stunning. Now that you've created one lasting masterpiece here of visuals, what's next for you? What projects do you have lined up now?
Well, I'm still waiting to see if Edgardo Mortara will finally get shaped. And because we started last year, as soon as I got back from...
Oh, for Spielberg?
Yeah. I've been involved in the project. We've been prepping a couple of months, and then the project folded. But I know that they still want to do it, and there is a rumor that it's going to get done next year. So let's see it.
He's already finished, hasn't he? Ready Player One's production too, and he's finished The Post.
He finished last year. And then I think that, and we were just about to start the pre-production in mid-February this year, that he decided to do the other project, which is more connected with the Trump problems and things.
Right. Well, I hope that one happens. That would have Mark Rylance coming back too, right? The kidnapping of Edgar Mortara?
Yes. Yeah.
And I understand you're also working on a Danny Boyle project?
Yeah, which is finished now, and it's going to be aired on February, I think, very, very, very soon.
Are there any other big projects that you have in the pipeline, or do you finally get a break?
Well, I'm trying to get a break as soon as I can, because, yes, there is something else cooking. Let's see what's happened.
Ooh, okay. Well, I can't wait to find out what that is, even if you can't tell us. So, Alessandra, unless you have any other comments to tell our listeners about your work on Blade Runner, that's pretty much all I have for you today. Thank you so much for coming on. Do you have any last-minute Blade Runner thoughts?
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much for calling me, and thank you very much for the conversation.
Oh, absolutely. To our listeners, this has been the Next Best Picture Podcast's interview with Alessandra Kerstrola. You can find me on Twitter at Mavericks Movies, and you can find more about our podcast Insight at www.nextbestpicture.com. Thank you so much for listening, and be sure to go see Blade Runner while it's in theaters, and give a shout out to this woman's incredible set decoration.